House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is May 1st, 2017.
The first of May.
Stop, stop. We'll open Senate Bill 890 and call Senator Taylor, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 890 retains any legal privileges applicable to information and records provided by an agent of the city to an elected city auditor when those records or information are provided for an audit or investigation. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Please.
Okay, thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. As you know, my professional background is as a management auditor in the public sector and in order to help make government at all levels more efficient and transparent. And so I am here today with Ms. Caballero, who is the elected auditor for the City of Portland, to speak in favor of Senate Bill 890. Taxpayers expect auditors to provide rigorous oversight of government programs. An auditor's ability to do this work depends on unfettered access to agency records. In the absence of statutory protections preserving privilege, agencies often withhold legally privileged information from auditors out of concern that sharing it waives the agency's privilege. This leads to potentially incomplete or inaccurate audits and investigation, which in turn may prevent agencies from identifying problems and improving performance. Senate Bill 890 safeguards access to information for elected city auditors by providing that their office's review of privileged information in the course of an auditor investigation does not waive the city's privilege. The bill does not impact the ability of the whistleblowers to make information public. Senate Bill 890 ensures that elected city auditors and their staff have access to information they need to do their job. I'm very pleased to support it and encourage this committee to do so as well. We deliberately narrowed the scope of the on the Senate side by ensuring it only applies to those specific records and information disclosed for the purpose of an audit or investigation. I'm going to turn things over to the City of Portland Auditor and Elizabeth Edwards to go into greater detail and to answer questions.
Thank you,
Chair Barker, members of the committee.
For the record, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Elizabeth Edwards with the City of Portland. The bill is short, so I will keep my comments short as well. Just here to introduce our auditor, Mary Hill Caballero, and say that this is really about increasing oversight and making government work better. And with that very high-level overview, I'll be here for questions.
Okay, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Mary Hall Caballero, and I am the elected auditor for the City of Portland. And I am here to urge your support for Senate Bill 890, which is critical to my office's ability to hold city government accountable on behalf of the public. The City of Portland's auditor is elected to act as a watchdog over the city's executive branch. The auditor's office conducts oversight through a unique combination of accountability tools. In addition to performance audits, we investigate police misconduct complaints and monitor officer-involved shootings. Our ombudsman investigates complaints from members of the public who believe the city has treated them unfairly or unjustly, and we enforce lobbyist regulations. To do this work effectively, we require complete, unfiltered, and timely access to information and records. The public expects that our audits and investigations draw on all, not just some, of the facts. They expect the auditor's office, not the agencies that are subject to our oversight, to decide whether information is relevant to a particular audit or investigation. The need to review legally privileged information comes up most frequently in the context of our investigations, but it also comes up in audits. For example, we are currently auditing the city's risk management office, which assesses the public's liability claims against the city. Many of risk management's records contain privileged information. Without access to this information, a critical city function involving millions in tax dollars may not receive the level of scrutiny that the public expects. I am mindful of the need to protect legal privilege, particularly when the city is involved in litigation and should remain on an even playing field with its courtroom opponents. But holding government accountable and protecting the city's legal position need not be mutually exclusive. Senate Bill 890 is the right fix. It is a limited and carefully drafted proposal that is modeled after similar provisions in Oregon law and other jurisdictions. It would ensure that my office's review of legally privileged information in the course of conducting audits and investigations would not waive the city's privilege. Passage of this bill would be a net gain for government transparency and accountability. We are very grateful to Senator Taylor for her support and for drafting this bill, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before your committee, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Greenick, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My assumption is when you have access to data that's otherwise privileged, it's privileged to avoid its disclosure in other fora. Would you be able to maintain the confidentiality of that data? Do you still have privilege, or could a newspaper reporter request that information from you under a public information inquiry that they could not get from the original source?
If we receive confidential or privileged information, then we have to respect the confidentiality that originally was attached to that information. And the situation that we're trying to resolve with this bill is when we receive privileged information that we're not violating the privilege. And if that were to happen, then that would make it accessible to an outside request, or most likely in a litigation setting where the other side would argue that the privilege had already been waived.
If I may follow up.
Yeah.
So the fact that you have this information as a part of your inquiry or an audit would mean if a newspaper reporter asked for it under public information, they would not have access to that data. Because you had it?
Right, that's correct. We would not turn that information over to them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 890 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 26.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 26 directs the County Commission to appoint a provider of victim services to the local public safety coordinating council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, here today in support of Senate Bill 26, and suddenly feeling very naked from the neck up.
He looks outstanding. He could very easily be a trooper.
He could be. Short his hair a little bit.
So Senate Bill 26, it's a very simple bill. It does one thing. It adds a community-based nonprofit victim service representative to the local public safety coordinating councils. In 2013, House Bill 3194 was passed. In that legislation, 10% of those funds goes to people from this group, from that nonprofit community. As the CJC, we were in charge of implementation of those dollars, and when we worked with the LIPSIX, we got a lot of feedback from them that was, well, who are these people? How do we get in touch with them? How do we know who they are? And so it seemed to us that there was a disconnect between the LIPSIX and this community. The LIPSIX are also the body that actually figures out where this money goes. So it makes sense to us to actually put them on the LIPSIX, or at least a representative from that community, so that they can have that dialogue, hopefully get more in connection with one another as community-based victim service providers and the local public safety coordinating council, and help facilitate and make those decisions. So it's a pretty simple and straightforward bill, and it's really just meant to bring together those two communities as they work together around justice reinvestment.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt, for being here. This is exactly what that portion of 3194 was about. And so this is the natural progression of how we deal with that 10%, because that was the hope, is that we would bring into the public safety conversation victim services at the local level. So I'm very excited about this.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Okay. Close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 26.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And since you're thrilled, would you please carry it for us?
I'm so thrilled, I'll carry it.
Okay. Representative Williamson will be the carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 131.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 131 modifies the circumstances under which a court may allow telephonic or other remote location testimony in civil and juvenile dependency proceedings. The bill authorizes the court to allow remote testimony in these proceedings for good cause unless the court finds prejudice to the other party outweighs good cause. The bill identifies a non-exclusive list of factors for the court to consider in making both the good cause determination and the prejudice determination. And the bill does retain the requirement that the court has to find video transmission is unavailable before allowing telephonic or other non-visual transmission. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. Call Aaron Knott and Mary Sell, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General here in support of Senate Bill 131, So a little background on what brought this bill about. In 2016, a case came down from the Court of Appeals called DHS v. KAH. This case involved a dependency proceeding. Basically, a young child was taken to the hospital in Pendleton. Head injuries, mom saying that older brother fell on the child. Child was harmed enough that they ended up being transported to Dornbecker's. The treating physician at Dornbecker's concluded that the injuries were consistent with a subdural hematoma, consistent with abuse. And so that was ultimately routed back to the prosecuting authorities out in Pendleton. They initiated dependency proceedings. In the hearing that followed, there was an attempt made by the state to introduce the testimony of the Dornbecker's treating physician telephonically. The defendant, the mother, objected and said, my case is being prejudiced by not having this person here physically. That went up on appeal. Now, the resulting case, which concluded that, in fact, live testimony was necessary and appropriate, given the very significant liberty interests that are involved in having your child taken away or your parental rights terminated, but that ruling and the case that followed was the first sort of description of the state of the telephonic testimony statute that we'd had in decades. And in that ruling, the judge notes, and I'm, for the sake of the record, indulge me one paragraph, the initial phrase of ORS 45.400, which is the telephonic testimony statute, providing that the trial court may order testimony by telephone, suggests an entrustment of discretion to the trial court. But the subsequent language in the statute largely or completely eliminates that discretion. That is because the statute goes on to clarify that the trial court, quote, shall allow telephonic testimony for good cause in cases other than jury trials, except that in certain enumerated instances, the court, quote, may not allow such testimony. Now, this is one of those shall not versus may not questions that in this case makes a very significant difference, because the remainder of that statute, the way it's written, and what brings us to Senate Bill 131A, has a long list of factors that if they're present to any degree under this Court of Appeals ruling, you couldn't have telephonic testimony. For example, if a witness has the potential to be outcome determinative. Well, those of us that have practiced, and there are more than in most in this committee, almost any witness has the potential to be determinative of something. That doesn't necessarily mean that you need them for live testimony or that their absence would prejudice the other party. To give you an example, you're litigating over business records. Well, those business records are going to come in and they're going to be litigated as long as you have a witness who's competent to lay the foundation, basically to say, these are my business records. It doesn't turn on their credibility. They're just there to lay foundation. And the idea that you need to have somebody drive in 100 miles to do that, potentially shutting their own business down, is the reason why we have a telephonic testimony statute in the first place. Now, it's very important for the appellate record to make very, very clear, telephonic testimony is not the preference in law. It's always better to have a live witness. This committee understands that. You sometimes take testimony over the phone. It's not as good. That's a reality. At the same time, sometimes you do have non-essential witnesses with bad backs who are 100 miles away, who can't get in without shutting down their business. So we pulled a group together, the Bar, OTLA, ODAA, OCDLA, and the Judicial Department to try to get at this. And the goal was give discretion back to the trial court. Let them make a smart call within sort of the purview of the judge about, is this telephonic testimony necessary? Is there a good reason for why we're bringing it in? And if it comes in, is there the risk of prejudice to the other party? And, you know, I think it's our hope and expectation as practitioners that in most cases, this will all be done by stipulation. People, the lawyers will work out a way to do it. But litigation's confrontational, and we cannot rely on that. So 131A is the brain product of pretty much every legal stakeholder we could drag into a room. We did reach consensus, I believe, completely on the language, and it did come across unanimously. So I encourage your support. I'm open for any questions.
Okay, Representative Vile.
This one frustrates the heck out of me, Aaron, just because I've used this statute dozens and dozens of times, and the courts already look at this as a common sense list of things to think about when they're showing good cause. It already says, except as provided under subsection 4, the court shall allow telephone testimony upon a showing of good cause. Upon a showing of good cause, you have the discretion, judge, what is good cause, and then the list is, again, just common sense. I'll support the bill, but I am frustrated with the fact that we are spending time because one judge got hypersensitive about something, and now we've decided to rewrite it again and opened it back up for more appellate scrutiny.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I think you read it the same way we all read it prior to the decision coming down in 2016, which was a judge has broad discretion to apply those factors. Those are the common sense factors that they use to referee their courtroom. I would encourage you to read and would be happy to send over DHS v. KAH. Part of what pulled us all together is we feel like the ground did move under our feet to some degree, and that we had been laboring under the assumption that judges had more discretion than it turns out they had. In terms of noodling around in the statute too often, this is the first revisitation I think we've made of the telephonic testimony statute. And oh, we talked about this in the work group, but it's been decades. This has been not an area of heavy legislative activity, which is part of the sparseness of the appellate record.
Mm-hmm. Nor should it have been, I'm feeling.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Knott is correct. We were present in the room. We are neutral on the bill, and I kind of wanted to explain how our concerns were met. During the course of the months, essentially, that we were working on this, there were a lot of stakeholders in the room, and we had a lot of conversations about whether or not the statute itself actually needed to be reworked. Ultimately, I think that there was a lot of agreement that KAH was actually decided correctly, that in cases where you've got essentially someone's parental rights at stake, there should be a butt in the chair. You should be relying on live testimony when there's such important issues at stake. So KAH probably was ultimately decided correctly, but the issue that was essentially being addressed was what's the explicit process that the judge should go through when determining whether or not someone should come into court or not and testify in person or not. And so the way that we're looking at kind of the reworking of the statute is all of the good cause factors and all of the prejudice factors are essentially what already existed in statute, but it's kind of giving an explicit kind of order of operations, if you will, to the judge on how the judge is supposed to weigh someone's good cause, but also weigh whether or not the person who's objecting is being prejudiced. OCDLA's concern, what we really brought to the table and what we were worried about essentially the whole time, was to make sure that when we're dealing with super serious interests, such as liberty interests, so when we're talking about people's children's being removed from their homes, and parental rights, so actual parental rights being terminated in these dependency cases, we wanted to make sure that the court is going to be able to look at the statute and ultimately give essentially due consideration to those interests. We went back and forth, and we put up a good fight, you guys, but ultimately I think that our concerns were addressed, and so we're neutral on the bill. We think that ultimately a judge is going to be able to look at the situation, especially given kind of the reworking of the prejudice factors, and say you know what, we're dealing with a special case here, and sorry, your witness has to be here and have a butt in the chair. And so that's our perspective. I'm happy to answer questions, but that's kind of the thought process that we went through in order to be here and be neutral.
Representative Greenlee. Mr. Chair, thank you. I wonder if we're skipping a generation here. I mean, when we're talking about telephonic, are we talking about a telephone, or are we talking about such things as Skype and video communications and things that would put a live picture of a person? It's a very different experience, I think.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, we had that conversation. They are a different experience. I think all parties agree that they offer up different levels of evidentiary value in terms of assessing character or anything like that. So there are provisions in the bill that make clear that telephonic testimony, which is actually a telephone, it's audio only, can be used only when video conferencing is unavailable. That video conferencing is statutorily preferred when you can get it and when it works. So we did have that conversation.
And it is taken into account in the bill.
Yes.
And Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I did some of my kind of own research on the side to figure out how many counties are actually able to do video transmission, and a lot of them are. I mean, I just kind of started alphabetically, and the phone calls that I was making speaking to the court administrators, they were saying that a lot of the courtrooms are able to do video transmission. And so that's another kind of safeguard in the statute that we support. That we're in a neutral way, but we're grateful that's there. We mutually support it, but it's something that addresses one of the concerns that we had, and so it's the bill actually says it's preferred. Video transmission is preferred if it's available. That's what needs to happen, and then only then, if that's not available, would you revert to a telephone.
Any further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 131 and open a work session on Senate Bill 131.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 131A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 131A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none. Representative Bowell, would you like to carry that for us?
Okay.
I can give somebody else
like
a
response.
No, that's fine. Thanks.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 826.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 826 includes qualifying victim services programs that are administered by a tribal government within the scope of the victim counseling privilege.
Aaron Nutt and Michelle Roland Schwartz.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Aaron Nott, Legislative Director for the Oregon Attorney General and the Department of Justice, here in support of Senate Bill 826. This is a simple but very important bill. In 2015, this body passed House Bill 3476, which I think made our confidentiality protections for victims among, if not the best in the nation. It was a very, very good bill, and I was very proud to have been a part of it, and I think all of you for your involvement. Many of you were very prominent on that bill. There was an oversight in the time that bill was assembled. They failed to realize that tribal advocates actually are housed in a different statutory definition than other advocates. It was a mistake at the time. They should have been included. I'm here to remedy that now. So all this bill does is make explicitly clear that tribal advocates will be given the same treatment as other advocates for victims of sexual assault.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michelle Roland Schwartz. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. Proud to be here in support of Senate Bill 826. I will keep my comments brief. We know that rates of sexual violence against women nationally is 1 in 5, and among tribal women, we see more than 1 in 3 experience sexual violence at some point in their life. Having access to confidential services where victims can be very open about their needs and do safety planning and access resources is of a critical importance. And when they restrict what they share, advocacy is not able to tailor their response in a way that's meaningful. We were really pleased with the passage of House Bill 3476 in 2015. We're grateful for the leadership of the Attorney General and all of you for passing that bill. In the first year of implementation on our campuses, we saw 136% increase in students accessing advocacy services, and see that bill is working in Oregon, and believe that we will see a similar increase for our survivors who are members of our tribal nations. So for those reasons, we urge your support. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 826.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 826 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 826 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gorsuch, would you carry that bill for
sure.
us, please? Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? Committee, we stand adjourned. Anything else for the good of the order?